RadioInfluence.com.
He got him in the white trunks. He heard it.
Beautiful.
Oh, God.
That's beautiful. He's got it.
And he forced the top. Wow. Here's Lucas and Mitchell. And it's all over. It's all over. First round knockout. He's out. Rich Franklin retains his belt.
The one thing that I never thought in a million years would happen, happened.
The champion. The challenger. Here we go.
This is the MMA Report with Jason Floyd on Radio Influence.
Welcome to the July 11th episode of the MMA Report podcast. Of course, I am Jason Floyd. As always, I am joined by Daniel Galvan. Come here on this week's episode of the podcast. We're going to take a look back at what happened last weekend in Las Vegas at UFC 226 and the Ultimate Fighter finale. Plus, we'll get you ready for this weekend's MMA. Plenty of MMA to take in. On Friday, we have Bellator 202. Then on Saturday, we have UFC Fight Night 133 and Bellator 203. Plus, we'll have our buy sell segment, and I'm going to have three interviews for you. We're going to talk to Patricio Pitbull, who of course is going to be defending the Bellator featherweight title against Daniel Vichel. You'll also hear from Daniel Vichel. Talk to both of those guys about kind of the little back and forth they had on social media. Plus, had a very interesting conversation with Michael McDonald. Of course, takes on Eduardo Dantas. So all those interviews come up here later on in the podcast. But Daniel, how you doing, man?
Jason, I am doing quite well after this weekend. It is apparent that my two loves, professional wrestling and mixed martial arts, are merging together into one baby. How'd you like the Monday Night Raw action on UFC 226, Jason?
Speaking of Raw, did I see it correctly that Brock Lesnar was not even mentioned on Raw on Monday about what he did over the weekend?
Yeah, which is okay. It could be a wrestling. There's a lot. Okay, there's a lot of wrestling things that are happening that are crazy. Two things happened. I'll mention the second one after. But yeah, they're doing a storyline where, okay, in WWE, here's Daniel explaining wrestling to Jason. In WWE, there's this one guy named Roman Reigns they want people to cheer for, but no one does because they kind of forced him on it. And he's the guy they want to beat Brock Lesnar. So their storyline they're doing is that Brock Lesnar is putting off wrestling in the WWE because he wants to do other things. So they're doing that storyline. Now, on Monday Night Raw, they didn't mention what he did, so they could either actually be mad at Brock Lesnar or it's a real subversive storyline. I think it might be the latter because, like, again, he's your WWE champion. And also, on the very same Monday Night Raw, they made plenty of mention of Ronda Rousey being at the UFC Hall of Fame. And then the second thing I wanted to point out is there was a New Japan wrestling show, Jason. I don't know if you saw this, but Josh Barnett was on commentary. And I thought this whole thing was actually fake. It was a work, but it was not. Josh Barnett was doing commentary with good old Jim Ross. And in the middle of the match, one of the wrestlers suplexed the other one into a barricade that knocked down the elderly Jim Ross. And Josh Barnett actually jumped the barricade and kind of got in the face of the other wrestler, which I thought was a work, but apparently that was real. That was a shoot. He decided to that. And the thing is, in professional wrestling, if you're not in the ring, you're taught to make everyone else look good. If you're a commentator, the wrestler should be scary. But it's hard to do that, I guess, if you're a former UFC heavyweight champion.
I did see the WWE did have a tweet, I want to say on Sunday, about Brock's appearance. And, I think it had been long rumored that Brock was going to be at UFC 226. And, Brock is not a guy that's just showing up at fights because he wants to see two guys or ladies go in there and have a fight. He's there for a reason. He was there to make himself a fight, he's not eligible to fight till January 8th. So, we're going to see Brock Lesnar at some point, but, before we get to the Brock Lesnar aspect of this, Daniel Cormier makes history. We talked about it last week. If he won that fight, he's got to be in the conversation as one of the greatest fighters of all time and, goes out there, gets the win. There is a part of me that really wonders what Jon Jones was doing on Saturday night. The fact of his arch enemy, Daniel Cormier, did what he wanted to accomplish, being a two-weight division champion. Daniel does it all before him, which makes you kind of sit there. But when I was thinking about greatest of all time, and you think about fighters that immediately come to mind, Cormier's got to be in that conversation. Anderson Silva, George St. Pierre, John Jones, Fedor Emelianenko, you know, just kind of names that just immediately pop off. The Demetrius Johnson, another one. Is there someone that I'm not thinking off the top of my head that should be in that conversation?
I think you nailed everyone. And this was something I thought a lot about this morning, kind of going over what we're going to talk about, because this absolutely becomes a discussion point, and we kind of touched on it prior. But this is before actually seeing what happened at UFC 226, which is just not what I expected. Obviously, I knew how talented Daniel Cormier is, but goodness, man, this was a legacy-defining win. This was absolutely a victory that turns the conversation much more serious when you say, is Daniel Cormier the best fighter of all time? He's a reigning two-division champion, and he went up against what – one would argue is the greatest heavyweight of all time. It's either him or Fedor and Stipe Miocic, reigning champion. He went up to his weight class and knocked him out in the first round. Obviously, Stipe had some nice moments in the early part of that first frame. But, hey, man, on the feet, I thought Stipe was going to get the better of the fight. That was not the case. When there was space, Cormier had so much success, and he caught Miocic. So I was not ready to really have this conversation about Daniel Cormier being the best of all time. But after watching him fight on Saturday, I think this conversation is absolutely valid. I think the only way you can unequivocally say he is the best of all time is obviously if he beats John Jones, which I think that fight will happen at some point. I think the John Jones-Daniel Cormier story is like potentially the greatest story in the history of the promotion when you really look at it. If you go all the way back to Daniel Cormier failing to be the very best when he was an amateur wrestler in the Olympics, all the trials and tribulations to go to the UFC, win every round. The one guy who beats him is John Jones, who gets popped for steroids a couple times. And now, late in his career, he has an opportunity to win a fight against John Jones. I mean, Jesus, that's a beautiful story. To answer your question, Jason, upon reflection, this is the way I settled at things. I feel in my heart of hearts that John Jones is the best fighter that I've ever seen, but I don't really feel comfortable giving him that honor just given the drug suspension. Same goes for Anderson Silva, but I would still put both those guys over Cormier and Demetrius Johnson. I would put Cormier and Demetrius Johnson at 4 and 5 presently. I would put Fedor at 6, and currently at number 1 I'd put George St. Pierre.
Yeah, I mean, George is a guy I had number one. I mean, and you mentioned about the tough part about John is there is this cloud over him. I mean, if he did not have these failed drug tests, there'd be no question. He'd be the greatest fighter of all time. And, you know, Dana kind of talked about that a little bit. But one of the things of now that we're a couple days past UFC 226, outside of Stipe mentioning this on social media, I haven't seen much talk of an immediate rematch. And when you think about the UFC heavyweight title, how much this title changes hands prior to Stipe Miocic, a guy that had 3 consecutive title defenses, I would think that maybe there would be a little more talk about him getting an immediate rematch, but they're really outside of Stipe. There's none of that, which, I mean, I get that he lost decisively in the first round, but when you think about it wasn't that long ago, Joanna Jędrzejczyk got an immediate title matchup after being knocked out decisively.
Yeah, I will say this, though, Jason. Despite the fact that Stipe has been a dominant champion, I think it's a little different when you're a dominant champion and you lose decisively in a fight that's close in terms of the betting odds, and if you're a dominant champion and you're like a massive favorite. I think that's the difference between Joanna and Stipe, is that the shock of her losing is so crazy that you want to see the rematch, whereas the shock of Stipe losing to Cormier, it was surprising to me, but it wasn't shocking because we know how good Cormier is. In that Joanna situation, I mean, she appeared to be a phenom, and no one in that weight class could step up to her. So the common fan wants to see her get the rematch. And the other thing there is people wanted to see Joanna get that rematch. There wasn't a whole lot of other potential fights. Obviously, Stipe Miocic deserves a heavyweight championship fight over Brock Lesnar. But there is much more interest in a Brock Lesnar-Daniel Cormier fight. There is much more interest in a John Jones-Daniel Cormier fight. And fortunately for Stipe, there aren't a whole lot of other people that will jump over him. Derek Lewis and Francis Ngannou did not necessarily have impressive performance leading up to the main event fight. So I just don't think people are clamoring for that Stipe rematch because there are much more attractive fights on the table for Daniel Cormier. And clearly he's going to get put in a position where he's one fight away for a title shot. But, you know, maybe the next time Stipe may never have an opportunity to get in the cage with Daniel Cormier again if he only wants to fight two more times, because that is unfortunate for Miocic. But if you're Daniel Cormier and all you care about is going to the bank, getting all that money, to me it's a Lesnar fight. It's a John Jones fight. And there has been some rumors or some talk about maybe him going back to 205 and potentially maybe defending the title one more time. To me, when I look at Daniel Cormier, I feel like his career is laid out pretty nicely. And it's a fight against Lesnar. It's a fight against John Jones. And after that, he can deposit the world's greatest check.
We did get a question from Scott about Daniel Cormier and him being determined to retire at the age of 40. And, of course, he asked about the John Jones fight, which that question is actually going to come up in our buy-sell segment about that. But, you know, I've seen Curtis Blaze's comments, you know, where, you know, he's – and I understand why Curtis is making the comments he is about Brock Lesnar. But, you know, this is – yes, this is a sport, but this is also entertainment, and this is the money-making business. And, you know, sorry, Curtis Blaydes, you're just not going to make the business that Daniel Cormier can make with either John Jones or Brock Lesnar. I mean, you know, we'll see whenever the USADA announcement comes down on John Jones. His manager, Malky Kawa, was on Luke Thomas's show this week, and he mentioned about they were looking maybe in this month that a decision would finally come down, but we've heard this from Malky in the past of other dates, so we'll see it. But, I mean, for Daniel Cormier, to me, if you only want two more fights, there is not a fight at 205 pounds not named John Jones that's going to make him any money. And he was brutally honest in the post-fight press conference. If no one saw that, I put a piece up on the MMAReport.com where he talked about how, you know, yeah, Gustafsson, if he gets a win, looks impressive. Yeah, there's something there, but they've done business together. And his exact quote is, "We didn't make any money." Now, the other side of that is I feel like Daniel Cormier also has to look at himself in the mirror in terms of that and say, are people willing to go out of their way to spend money just because he's fighting, or does it have more to do with what his opponent is? You know, I think in an ideal, perfect world, and I don't think this is realistically, Daniel, is that somehow John Jones is eligible to fight December 29th, 2018, and we see the trilogy matchup between Jones and Cormier. I don't think that's possible. I think the absolute best case you're looking at Jones is he gets a two-year suspension, retroactive to last year, so you know we're looking, you know, August of 2019 before we see Jones, but time will tell on that one. So he's mentioned Shogun, but if Daniel Cormier only wants to fight two more times, there's just nothing for me at 205 for him to take, you know, from a financial aspect. If I'm him, I just sit there and you know what, you fight Brock, you know, sometime in January or maybe Super Bowl weekend.
Yeah, like fighting Alexander Gustafsson is taking the risk of fighting John Jones without the reward. You know, you fight a guy like Brock Lesnar, Daniel Cormier is justifiably going to be a massive favorite against Lesnar, despite the fact that, by God, those two guys in the cage, Lesnar dwarfed him. It was crazy. It was just visually crazy to see those two toe-to-toe, but we all kind of know that. In all likelihood, it's going to be a nice night for Daniel Cormier, unless he gets caught, which it could happen to anyone. Gustafsson, you know, they're not going to make a lot of money, and Gustafsson might just beat him. He might not. I mean, Daniel Cormier is in his peak at 39 years old, but I assure you this, Jason. One, John Jones should not fight in December, okay? I mean, realistically, this dude shouldn't fight for 4 years. this dude deserves a four-year suspension if we're doing the guidelines, but we're not because he's John Jones and we don't care. And obviously, there's some pushback on whether or not 4 years is, you know, the right move for a two-time offender, you know. But Tom Lawler, you know, that'd be ironic if, like, John Jones comes back before Tom Lawler does and other guys. So I don't think it's December. I like what you're putting down. Two-year retroactive suspension makes a lot of sense. So I think Daniel Cormier is going to fight at age 40. I know he's been real steadfast about it, but I just think it's pretty simple. You do that January fight with Brock Lesnar when he gets cleared, and then you have a really eventful summer. One last fight, John Jones, Daniel Cormier. I think the paycheck for that fight will cause Cormier to put off his retirement just a few months, Jason.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one. I think there's just too much money sitting on the table for Daniel Cormier to have two fights by March of 2019, and one of them's not John Jones.
It's not just money, right? It's legacy. It is 100% legacy, because if he beats John Jones, I think he's legitimately potential. Like there's a real case that he's the best. Like, you could say he's the best fighter of all time and not have a but after it. I think now you have a but after it. You could say it without a but.
Yeah, if he has a trilogy fight against John Jones and he beats him, and he beats Brock Lesnar, I don't know. It's going to be tough not to call Daniel Cormier the greatest of all time. I mean, it's just the guy is, and he's the poster boy of what the UFC wants every champion to be. You know, they don't got to worry about Daniel Cormier getting into the kind of trouble that we've seen John Jones get himself in the trouble. But you mentioned about legacy, and that's actually something Daniel talked about last week of you know, wanting to build on his legacy. You know, there's no doubt in my mind he wants to be known as the greatest fighter of all time. And you know, if he can end his career with you know, a win against Brock Lesnar, which, I mean, look, it's not like he beat the Brock Lesnar of, you know, 2012 or 2011. It's a 2018 version, but it's going to make him a lot of money. And Daniel, he's been open and honest about it, where he's looking for the biggest money fights possible just because he's trying to call this thing a career. So I can't blame him. I mean, you know, he mentioned Shogun about going down 205 to fight him. I mean, Shogun's got a tough fight against Anthony Smith, and I don't think that's a guarantee that Shogun walks away, even though, man, I think that's not a fight that gets me excited as a main event of a fight night card.
Yeah, I was going through the cards this weekend, and I remember when this fight was announced after Reflection, but I saw Shogun versus Smith. I was like, man, Leslie Smith really getting thrown to the wolves here. as I forgot, you know, Anthony Smith did have a great victory, but you're talking about headlining a show with a dude who's not even a part of the top 15 in a division. Yeah. In a division that isn't necessarily stacked, Jason. I mean, we are not talking about the lightweight division when it comes to Smith. So, I mean, that fight to me sets up as a Shogun who highlight, you know, one of those similar to kind of the way the career of Dan Henderson ended, where we're trying to force him back to a championship contendership through fights that set up nicely for him. I mean, I think Anthony Smith's going to provide a potentially a rough night for him, but if Shogun Hua still has it, I mean, that's a perfect opportunity. You can't ask for a better opportunity than headlining a show with Anthony Smith.
Now, we don't want to sit here and talk too much about Francis Ngannou and Derek Lewis because, well, that fight just sucked.
But let's do 33 words on it for each striker, 31 words. By God, what the hell is that?
But here was the interesting thing that came out after this fight was over, and it came from Dana White, where he was talking about Francis Ngannou, where he said, quote, "He had a pretty quick rise here, and obviously the fight over Alistair Overeem catapulted him. Everybody was talking about him. I thought he was going to be the next guy. I think his ego ran away with him big time. I can tell you that his ego absolutely did run away with him. And the minute that happens to you in the fight game, you see what happens. You start to fall apart. I had some personal encounters with him, as did other people in the organization. And this guy's ego was just out of control. Before the Stipe fight, he took off and went to France. Didn't really even train for that fight, and you see the result. Well, then he comes back, and he did train, but ego is what hurt Francis Ngannou." Now, that's the Dana White quote, which the reason that quote jumped out to me is because we know Francis Ngannou was, like, 7 months ago, was the poster boy of the UFC Performance Institute. So clearly, Francis Ngannou has not been the model gym member at the UFCPI, I guess that's the way I take it. Is clearly there has been some issues there at the PI with Francis Ngannou.
You think he's not wiping down the gym equipment after he does, you know, he just leaves all the sweat?
I
you think he's doing that?
my first thing is maybe is he not treating the employees of the UFCPI with the respect they deserve?
Well, he
that's just pure my speculation, not reporting it. But when I see that quote, that's one of the things that popped in my mind.
Well, I mean, it probably one of those things. It reminds me a lot of obviously he's not doing like all the drugs Johnny Manziel was doing. You know, that dude was going crazy. But it kind of reminds me of watching Johnny Manziel at Texas A&M. Just that, like, he had supernova-like success. And I guess for Johnny, it was jumping to the NFL. The level of competition changed. But I guess the level of competition changed for Ngannou when he faced Stipe. But anyways, the point is this. This was an amazing athlete, an amazing person at his sport. And in one instance, his performances have changed dramatically. And you begin to see people around him talking crap about him. Which, you know, likely means issues with maybe handling success, which is kind of sad. But he can obviously turn the ship around. And I think one way that will help him is easier opponents. I think I think Francis, even if he's changed, if you still put him in the cage with a lesser level heavyweight, he will likely still produce a highlight reel fight. But in this fight, it did not look like he wanted to fight. And this was an amazing opportunity for Francis Ngannou. Because you're talking about a fighter in Derek Lewis who is a really, really talented fighter, and his back was acting up. I mean, it's not going to get easier for against Derek Lewis than when his own body's turning against him. This was a perfect opportunity for Ngannou to have a dominant performance because it's just sad to see a guy like Derek Lewis, who I love watching time and again, and you see how it hurts him to be a part – despite winning, to be a part of a fight like this. And it sucks because, like, I want to see Lewis flourish, and I want to see him given the, you know, the best shot to potentially be a heavyweight champion. But even with the win here over Ngannou, like, the only discussion point I have is, like, God, maybe he's going to retire, because we already saw him do it once due to back problems, and it was apparent here again.
Yeah, I mean, when he brought up the back problems again, I mean, I guess my question is surgery not an option for him? Is this something that's not fixable by surgery, or is this something where if he does have surgery, he's going to be out for a long length of time? Because it does seem to come up every fight with Derek Lewis. You know, to me, looking what's next for Derek Lewis, you got to think Stipe Miocic could be the potential opponent. For Francis Ngannou, maybe someone like a Mark Hunt.
Oh, that actually seems like an awesome fight. I would love to sign me up for that fight. Would watch. That's a good stuff. I mean, that's still a tough opponent, but I think Mark Hunt will bring out the entertainment factor in Ngannou. And it, when we talk about these guys who struggle once they reach their initial peak, it all comes down to the people they surround themselves with on helping them kind of humble themselves and relearn what got them there in the first place. So I hope that happens because for Ngannou, this is still very much a guy that could be one of the better heavyweights we've seen in a long time. But upon being investigated by the spotlight, we've seen plenty of cracks in his game here. And this was an embarrassing fight to put on pay-per-view.
You know, when it comes to the rest of the fight card, some of the things that stuck out to me, Michael Chiesa, first off, misses weight. But how about let's not sit there and tell Anthony Pettis how you are going to send him to Bellator, because was he not thinking when he said that? Because what happens if there comes a point that Michael Chiesa wants to use Bellator to get more money out of the UFC?
Well, I think he's going to fight in Bellator one day. I think that's just how it works in MMA, right? If you say something like that
if I'm Scott Coker or Rich Chow, oh, when that day comes, you think I'm not going to have that clip ready to go?
Yeah, that's going to save you a couple thousand dollars.
Oh, that's going to hurt Michael Chiesa at the negotiating table.
Yeah, you're not wrong. You're not wrong. I mean, I would still go after him. I mean, this guy's got a great personality. But yeah, that was between that and his wardrobe at the weigh-ins, the press conference.
Oh my goodness!
You know, his hangover two wardrobe that you mentioned.
Where do you go and get that wardrobe?
You go and get it at like a prison cell. I don't know. I don't know where you get it at. I was surprised that this fight card. I mean, I was not surprised that this fight card happened in Nevada. And he dressed like it. And, man, I tell you what, though. How many times have we gone in here and said, is this the time Anthony Pettis is going to return to form? Is this going to be it? And, goodness, we saw it, Jason. Anthony Pettis is back. Michael Chiesa was a hell of a lightweight, a great fighter.
I'm not willing to say that yet.
Why not?
Show it to me another time. Put together another win like that.
I disagree. I disagree with you. You're not wrong to ask for consistency. What I do love is how he talked about a change in philosophy, where he basically said, I'm just not doing wrestling anymore. I'm going to practice on stand-up, and I'm going to practice on grappling. And wherever you take me, I'm going to kick your ass. Like, I like that. I mean, that may be a bad idea. Like, just maybe remember, there's enough time in the day to practice wrestling. Dave, but it worked tonight.
The last time Anthony Pettis won back-to-back fights was in 2013 and 2014.
2013, okay. Listen, man, that would be against like
Benson Henderson and Gilbert Melendez.
Okay, two of the greats. You just sound like a hater. You sound like you didn't vote for the Showtime kick for an ESPY.
No, you're not wrong. All I'm saying is show me some consistency before I'm going to sit here and say Anthony Pettis is back.
Well, you bring up a good point. I will just say since that point in 2014, there has not been a better Anthony Pettis performance than we saw at UFC 226.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we'll see what happens there. In terms of other things from 226 that stuck out to me, Khalil Roundtree with a knockout, Paulo Costa with his knockout, Rafael Sunsell gets another decision win, you know, and Dan Hooker on the Fight Pass prelims, man, a great performance by him over Gilbert Burns.
Yeah, I love that. You failed to mention a fight that I loved, bro. Mike Perry.
I thought you were going to do some sarcasm and go somewhere else.
I wasn't going to talk about Emily Whitmire and Jamie Moyle. Man, that was a tough one. That was one where I nearly fell asleep, man. That was rough. That was rough stuff. But what I did love about that fight was the post-fight. So, like, apparently Whitmire used to spend time with Vinny Magahayes in the gym. Like, he used to be a trainer or whatever. And he ends up being in the corner of Jamie Moyle. And basically, like, Whitmire told him to F off or something like that. I can't remember, but that was cool. I enjoyed that part. I like that.
By the way, you want to hear how bad of a night I had on Saturday night with my DraftKings team?
How bad?
So I built my team around Paul Felder.
Oh, God.
I had Stipe Miocic, Francis Ngannou, Rob Font,
and
Gilbert Burns all on my team.
Did you get 0 points?
I got like 20 points.
That's insane. I
felt so good about my team going into it. I'm like, oh, Ngannou got a real good chance at a knockout. I'm like, Stipe, you're going to fight for like 25 minutes. It's going to be a stand-up fight. I'm going to get you a lot of points. Gokhan Saki. Oh, I had Gokhan Saki too. I was like, man, I felt really good about my team. And then on Sunday morning when I checked it, because I knew how awful I did, I was like, holy cow, I suck.
Dude, I feel like if I asked you to predict six fights in – like if I said pick six losers on the next fight card until the end of time, you would never be able to do it. The odd of getting six similar – that's insane. That – crazy. Congratulations on that. And I mean, Paul Felder, feel for him breaking his arm or whatever, injuring his arm and still going out there and having an absolute bloodbath of Mike Perry. I mean, the wrestling for Mike Perry played out there. Khalil Roundtree can forever say he went in an octagon and knocked out Gokhan Saki. I mean, you can make the case that Saki's like the best striker in the UFC, and he just got beat up by Roundtree. What a performance by Khalil. You mentioned Hooker and Burns. I mean, that Hooker and Burns, well, I can't remember if we talked too much about it, but that was a great – when those two were in the cage, I was like, oh my goodness, this is an awesome fight. This is a great fight pass fight, and it delivered.
I mean, outside of the co-main event, if you put down your $65 to watch this pay-per-view, you were very entertained. You know, overall, top to bottom, it was a very good card. You know, Friday was the Ultimate Fighter finale. I did not watch that live. I actually watched it on Tuesday morning. And I when you're taping something on your DVR and it's a sporting event, they say you want to add this extension 30 minutes. I always know with MMA, you got to add those 30 minutes because you never know. I didn't think that I would still not catch the last round of Israel Adesanya and Brad Tavares, which I tweeted about this on Tuesday. Like, I ultimately feel bad for people who watch that event live, because if you're on the East Coast, you were up till past 1:30 in the morning watching that fight card.
Yeah, that was a long card. Obviously, the pacing isn't great. I saw you tweeted that out this morning. I I'm sorry you missed out. I'll explain to you what happened. Adesanya beat up Brad Tavares.
Oh, no. No, I mean, look, I saw 25 minutes of the fight. It was very clear, or 20 minutes of the fight, very clear what happened. But it made me, you know, as I was sitting there on my couch going, I cannot believe this. The UFC truly had a six-fight main card, lasts over 3 hours and 30 minutes. That was kind of my first thought. But then I started kind of thinking about this more and more, and we talk about how viewership is down for the UFC in Bellator in 2018, and it makes me wonder how much of this is due to the pacing of these television fight cards.
I think it's not the outright reason, but it's definitely a reason. It like builds upon the outright reason, which the outright reason is there aren't too many stars and they're not building them in oversaturation. But an additional reason is the actual process of watching the product. Not very fun, not very with the times, not very like what every other product is trying to do, increase the pace. We've talked about the idea of, like, as a society, I think everyone values time more. I think we're always freaking out that we're wasting too much time and, you know, we could have done something else. So to ask people to sit down for that long to watch six main card fights, much less 10 fights on TV, much less an entire 12 fight card, is a major ask. And I think it's definitely not the primary reason, but without a doubt, one of the reasons why viewership's declining. I think you're on to something, Jason.
I mean, and we talked about it. It's just watching these MMA cable cards, it's so much easier on DVR. Like, I'm to the point now, if I'm going to sit down on a Saturday night and watch events live, I feel like if the fight card starts like at 10 p.m. Eastern time, maybe I roll into the car about 10:45, and I just hit the play on the DVR from that point.
Yeah, it's got to be required viewing for me. It's got to be. There has to be a fight on there that I need to see live. That wasn't the case for the Ultimate Fighter finale. It's just too much easier to do the DVR. It allows me to do other things in my time. Sometimes I'm just working. So I like the strategy you employ. But also, if I'm going to watch it live, I kind of want to watch it live. Like, I enjoy the interaction on Twitter, so I usually start it live anyway.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that as I think the talking points after that card – obviously Israel Adesanya, you know, I don't think the UFC goes this route, but I could see them matching up him and Paulo Costa for that Brazilian fight night card later on this year, but maybe you try to keep those guys away from each other. Brad Katona, definitely a guy to pay attention to, moving forward. You know, probably the guy that you're most interested out coming out of the Ultimate Fighter. I think Luis Pena, you look at him as well. Bryce Mitchell, Tyler Diamond, that was a really good fight. If fans have not seen that fight, a very good fight. That was the opening matchup of the FS1 prelims. You know, but outside of that, was there what else? Did anything else really stick out to you?
I thought the best fight of the night was Caceres and Bravo, Bravo.
Oh yeah, I mean that in that third round where I mean, you know, he could have just kind of given up. You know, but he just went out there, man. You talk about fighting with heart.
To close out that fight was great. I mean, he very well could have stole that fight there, and he did on one judge's scorecard. I just love that fight, man. I sort of enjoyed Julian Marquez and Alessio De Chirico. I mean, a big struggle for this card was the amount of decisions that maybe impacted the overall enjoyment. You know, you mentioned Brad Katona. He looked great. Israel Adesanya, I did not expect that performance coming off the Vettori fight, but this fight was like a coming out moment. Him and Paulo Costa are very much in sync with one another, Jason, but I would not do that matchup. Those, to me, are two of the bright fighters at middleweight. You should separate them until they absolutely need to fight each other. Trezano Giannetti was not an enjoyable fight. You mentioned Sideshow Bob Luis Pena, looking great. The one other performance, or the two other female performances I liked, were Mata Ferry getting that UFC victory over Barb Honchak with the TKO, she, you know, out grappling her. And also Montana De La Rosa looked phenomenal against Rachel Ostovich.
By the way, speaking of women's MMA, I was fairly surprised to see that two of the three women's fights on Saturday's UFC Fight Night card and boys are on the prelims. And on the Fight Pass prelims, and that Jennifer Maia, who I think a lot of people prior to the UFC getting 125-pound business, felt she was the best 125-pound fighter out there, and she's on the featured Fight Pass prelim.
It's dumb, right? You're basically telling people not to care about your women's flyweight division because Jennifer Maia versus Liz Carmouche is like a number one contenders fight, especially if Maia wins. Like, you are telling your viewers that this does not crack the top 11 fights on a fight night card. That's what you're telling your viewers. And your viewers won't even hear this message because they won't even see the fight because it's on Fight Pass. It makes no sense. There are a lot of interesting fights on the FS1 card, but the fact that Jennifer Maia isn't on TV, you tell your viewers don't care about the women's flyweight division. I don't understand why they do this. They do this with the women's flyweight division. They do it with the flyweight division. And then they wonder why no one cares about these fights in these divisions. That's a big reason why, because you aren't doing the initial investment to get people to even know who the hell Jennifer Maia is.
Yeah, I mean, when I look at this fight night card on Saturday, you know, and when I look at my top fight from this fight card, there were two fights that immediately came to my mind. First one, the main event, obviously a lot of play there, JDS and Blagoy Ivanov. And the second fight that really has me interested on this one, and maybe it's on your list as well, and that's the return of Chad Mendez against Miles Jury.
Yeah, that's the fight I'm looking forward to the absolute most, Jason. I just think Chad Mendez, it's kind of funny how if a guy's gone for a while, you know, suspended, whatnot, you kind of forget that he ever existed. You know, I was looking at this fight card. I'm like, oh, Chad Mendez. That's a guy I forgot existed, you know, have not seen fight in multiple years. And, yeah, I'm looking forward to see how he performs. And the matchup with Miles Jury is really a great fight. I'm interested to see that fight, absolutely, Jason. And I think that fight is the fight I'm looking forward to, even more so than the heavyweight matchup, which is obviously great. It's always a good time when Junior Dos Santos stepped inside the cage and Blagoy Ivanov has a great opportunity. But I would say Miles Jury, Chad Mendes is definitely the top fight. And another one I'm really looking forward to is Darren Elkins versus Alexander Volkanovski on the prelims.
In terms of division, that may be one of the more important fights on this fight card in terms of where those guys are at the division.
The which fight?
Volkanovski and Elkins.
Yeah, absolutely. Which again begs the question, the way this card is mapped out, right? It's almost like this is a fight that maybe deserves to be on the main card or maybe the feature fight on the prelims.
Look, we all know why the co-main event is what the co-main event is.
Yeah, because Zach Otto is so handsome.
How is Zach Otto still the betting underdog?
I don't know. Well, you know,
missing something?
No, we're reverse jinxing him, though. Like, we are jinxing the hell out of him because whenever we have this conversation, like, we were talking about last week about how is Brad Tavares such a big underdog? And then, like, Adesanya kills him. So, congratulations, Sage Northcutt. Me and Jason are officially giving you the victory by asking why you're a favorite.
Yeah, I mean, my guess is this will be a DVR card for me on Saturday night. I don't know if I'll be, watching this one live.
Yeah, I think I'll watch the last few fights live, and it's largely due to the fact I just work, you know, USL soccer. But I think I'll get home in time, or I might just go to a bar and request them to put on Nico Price and Randy Brown or Cad Zingano and Aaron Renault. You know, there's only baseball going on. So
now, in terms of the Bellator cards, the Friday night card, the fight that has me the most interested,
Julia Budd, right?
No. Nope. That'd be Eduardo Dantas and Michael McDonald. You're here from Michael McDonald later on. Overall, not a bad fight card. Bellator's put it on Friday night on the Paramount Network. And then on Saturday, tape delay show. I believe it starts at 8 p.m. Eastern time on Paramount Network. Pitbull Vigil. I mean, that's a great fight. I mentioned this to the interviews I did with both fighters here in a little bit. Patricio Pitbull, I was looking at Tapology. They have him as the number 17th featherweight in the world and Daniel Vichel at number 21.
That's a massive disrespect to the Bellator featherweight division.
Oh, let's just say when I asked Patricio Pitbull that question, he was got a little fired up.
I believe it. I absolutely believe it. I'm sure it's crazy because, like, not only his ranking, but Daniel Weigel, I mean, this is a fighter who's won, like, God, it must be like 11 out of 12. And most of those wins are against quality competition. You know, guys we see in the UFC and guys who very much would contend in the UFC. So that's crazy. I think the
okay,
winner of this one.
Let's just go 16 above and tell okay. me if you would rank Patricio Pitbull ahead of him. Number 16, Andre Feely.
Ahead of him.
I agree. Zabit Magomed Sharipov.
As of what they've done, yeah, sure.
Even yeah, as of right now, yes. Maybe long term, maybe it's different.
Yeah.
Duho Choi.
Yeah, I would put him above Duho Choi.
I agree. Yair Rodriguez.
Man, that's a tough one. But
I think that would be a bad matchup for Patricio just because of Yair's size.
I think that's a fight I want to see. I think it's a fight I want to see.
Don't worry. We talked about Patricio's contract in the interview as well, so that comes up. We'll just kind of go quickly through these. Number 11, Josh Emmett. Number 10, Ricardo Lamas. Number 9, Renato Moncano. Number 8, Mirsad Bektik. 7, Darren Elkins. 6, Cub Swanson. 5, Jeremy Stevens. 4, Frankie Edgar. 3, Jose Aldo. 2, Brian Ortega. And number 1, Max Holloway.
Look, I think if you're wearing Pitbull panties, you could put him at 8. You could put him at 7 if you're feeling real good about it. But
he's
got
to be top 10. He's got to be in the lower top 10.
I think he's absolutely above Josh Emmett.
We didn't even mention Max Holloway, Brian Ortega. Man, that was a bummer.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We've become emotionless, right? Just week in and week out. You know, people like, I don't know who would binge listen to this podcast 15 years from now, but if someone's just cranking these podcasts out and they listen to the episode before, and they're like, man, they were so excited about Holloway and Ed Ortega, and they just don't talk about it on the post-fight show. Like, we're so used to doing these previews, and the fight doesn't happen. Yeah, that sucks, man. And it's a real weird situation with Holloway.
Yeah, and there's so much that we just don't know about what's going on there. I mean, you know, send the healing vibes out at the Max Holloway. I don't blame Brian Ortega for not sitting there wanting to take some short-notice fight just because there was so much on the line for him. That was when that news came down on Wednesday evening, that was a bummer, man. I was like, man, that was a fight you're looking forward to. But, you know, when you go back and you watch that appearance on UFC Tonight, this is my question about that interview. Why did FS1 air that interview? Because Max looked, I mean, and I know hindsight, you know, hindsight is a lot different when you look in the future, but like you watch that interview and you're just like, man, it just didn't paint Max in a good picture. So I don't know, because look, UFC Tonight is state run television. Okay. It's what Fox News is in the political world. It's state run UFC television. I never understood why they aired that interview.
Yeah. I don't understand it either. And it's like, I guess the only answer is there isn't a whole lot of oversight, right? Like, if we're looking at it from the perspective of state-run television and not the perspective of being a journalist, I don't gather the motivation of someone with the UFC's best interest in mind looking at that tape and being like, let's run it.
Yeah, I know. It's just, you know, and then the other thing is, like, there's this group of fans out there that just want fighters to take fights on a day's notice.
Yeah. Go ahead.
And the UFC is so, like, they just want fighters to be yes men. And that's not what they're here for.
Dude, the crazy thing is, like, not only do they want these guys to do these things, but they want to do these things at the peak of their lives, their professional lives. They've been working to get to this point. Brian Ortega has been working to challenge for the featherweight championship for a big portion of his life. And now he gets there, and now, you know, the fight gets canceled, and now people want him to sacrifice that paycheck, sacrifice that opportunity on a win. No, it's okay. You know who really wants to fight on Saturday? Brian Ortega. That dude really wants to fight. But when you get put in that situation, it takes a lot to put your foot off the accelerator and really make the best decision for yourself. Brian Ortega absolutely has earned that. It's just a crappy situation.
Yeah, it just is. And that kind of leads us into our buy-sell segment. We actually have 6 questions this week, and one of them is related to the featherweight title. The UFC should break out an interim featherweight title for UFC 227.
Ooh, I know who wants it. Brian Ortega. He's been calling for maybe something like that, and it feels nice to wrap a title around your waist, Jason, but I am selling this. Should? If the question is should, I'm selling this. If the question is would, I think they will because they have an infatuation with title belts, but by God, the interim title needs to be laid to rest.
Would you dare say the UFC has a fetish for interim titles?
I think somewhere, you know. I mean, like, I'm not saying Dana White's into being a part of like a dominatrix or whatever, but like nothing turns him on more than getting hit. Like he likes getting hit with the belt, but he likes getting hit with interim belts more. You know what I'm saying?
You know, yeah, I mean, and then I guess the question then becomes is it Frankie Edgar? Is it Jeremy Stevens? And then, you know, and then what happened, you know, then, you know, I guess, you know, in terms of the interim title, I guess the question has got to be is what's the future for Max Holloway? And the other thing is Max Holloway's days at 155 pounds over? In terms of this question, I'm selling it, and primarily because we have too many goddamn interim titles as it is.
I feel bad. I want to see a mockumentary-style video on the guy who has to make all the interim titles for the UFC, the overworked poor guy.
Yeah. Next up, the UFC made the right decision in giving the next middleweight title shot to Kelvin Gastelum. I'm buying this. I think they did make the right decision. It, just because it was between him and Chris Weidman. You look at Chris, there's been inactivity. Yes, he does have that win over Calvin Gastelum, but outside of that, it's not a great record for Chris Weidman his past couple fights.
I certainly understand that. I don't think it's wrong to give the title to Kelvin Gastelum, but I'm selling this just because I think the right move would be Chris Weidman. Specifically, I think a Weidman fight is a bit more marketable. I think the fact that he does have a win over Gastelum despite his inactivity justifies giving him a shot over Kelvin. So while I am selling this, I don't think it's wrong that Gastelum's getting it. I mean, looking at the way he beat Michael Bisping, looking at his awesome fight with Jacare Souza, this is absolutely a guy who deserves it. But to me, the right move is still Chris Weidman.
Yeah, I feel like Chris just needs to get another win to really kind of solidify his case.
And I feel for him because his next fight's probably going to be really tough. I don't know who it's going to be against. I don't know if it's going to be against Romero or Paulo Costa. But it's going to be a tough one. So that may be the issue for Weidman.
Next up, Daniel Cormier will have a trilogy fight against John Jones before retiring. I am buying this just simply because I can't see Daniel Cormier leaving that amount of money on the table.
Yeah, and I also talked about the legacy. I think the legacy is such an important part for Daniel in his life. Look, this guy's going to sleep well if he loses the rest of his fights or if he wins the rest. But I think there's a major part of him that from a legacy standpoint wants to get that hand raised when he steps in the cage with John Jones. And the money's nice, too. I'm buying this 100%. This fight's going to happen unless your side has anything to say about it, which, I mean, maybe they should, but we both know they probably won't.
Next up, the winner of TJ Dillashaw versus Cody Garbrandt will defend the bantamweight title next against Rafael Sunsal. And I am selling this, Daniel, because I think it's going to be Marlon Moraes.
Man, that's the saddest thing I've ever heard. I mean, you're not wrong. It's like, if you look at the history of the UFC, like there are a few things that we know will happen. You know, we know guys who retire, they'll come back. We know they can't stay away from the interim title. And we know that Rafael Sunsal will never get a championship opportunity. I mean, he has become the new joke, right? Like this guy's lost one time. And he started to fight two times. And he started fighting the UFC in 2011. Like, this guy's done a lot. And I feel like what's crazy is he mentioned that when he got interviewed by Joe Rogan, he said that's the first time Joe Rogan's ever interviewed him.
That's not, you know what? I mean, you can sit there and go, oh, he's got all these wins, but let's be honest about it. If you go out and you win by decision, what's the odds you get a post-fight interview?
Not great. And he's won by decision most of the times.
Look, you need style points. I mean, it's from a sporting aspect. Rafael Sunsal should get the next title fight, no question. But this is the entertainment business. And when you have a guy like Marlon Moraes who goes out there and has these flashy knockouts, I think he's going to get the next title fight.
That makes me real sad because I get it, but I'm buying this. I want to see a sense. And it's more because I'm buying it. Like deep down, I know the next fight will probably be Marlon Moraes, but just do a solid to a nice guy. You know, a nice guy who goes in, takes care of business, gets some takedowns, you know, does some outstriking with, you know, beats a tough Rob Font. I get Marlon Moraes went out there, destroyed Rivera, destroyed Aljamain Sterling, and looking real great. But I just feel bad for Rafael Sunsal. It makes me kind of sad inside to see him not get a title shot.
No, I'm with you. Next up, you mentioned Ronda Rousey at the beginning of the show, and this question is, Ronda Rousey is the most influential fighter in UFC history. I don't know how you don't buy this, Daniel.
Well, I think there are very few fighters that could potentially top her. I think the cheating answer or the obvious answer has to be Royce Gracie. But that's like the category she's into because that's a tough one. I might sell this because I might say Royce is above her just because it's the very start of the sport.
But I think, you know, look, without Ronda Rousey, there is no women's MMA in the UFC. Yes. She changed all that, you know, and she brought so much a different set of eyeballs to the UFC product that they just couldn't get. And so that's why I would buy it.
Yeah. And she's absolutely a part of the conversation. Like, she's right there. She literally brought an entire gender into the UFC, also impacted pro wrestling, I think, in the WWE. There's much more focus on women's wrestling as Ronda had success. So she's up there. I just think Royce Gracie, his influence really molded the entire sport and the UFC. His ability to have success, his story, jiu-jitsu, man, that sold beautifully. This is a toss-up. I'm just going to throw it out there, Jason. But between Randy Couture, Chuck Liddell, and Tito Ortiz, who do you think was the most important fighter for the UFC?
I'd probably have to say Chuck.
That's a great answer. That's a great answer. It's a tough one. Like, you could honestly make a case for anyone. I would almost say Tito just because, like, he was the perfect antagonist. He created so many different rivalries with so many different fighters.
But, I mean,
it could go either way.
I mean, you think about Chuck just because I just remember when you would go out for fights when Chuck was fighting, it brought such a huge crowd. Yeah. I mean, was Chuck maybe the first MMA fighter to appear on a television show like he did with Entourage?
I think so. I mean, look, I saw Taylor Tooley on Hawaii 5-0, but that was much later. So that could be, I mean, this dude was a superstar, you know, and Randy Couture is more like that. I mean, Randy Couture is right up there too. I think people loved him and it's a good question. You know, Chuck Liddell is just like, he's so cool. You know, he's that guy for like the rural dude, right? The rural dude who works on his car, you know, like Chuck Liddell is just like buff Larry the Cable Guy almost. I don't know. Crazy that he still has the same hairstyle, by the way.
And yeah, I guess we're going to see Tito Chuck. I guess that's really going to happen.
What'd you think of the little deal they had at the UFC Hall of Fame?
I think that's smart promotional tactics by them.
Yeah.
I mean, you know how much media is going to be there, you know, but that's just, I mean, not going to get me to buy that fight.
We're going to buy it. Jason.
If a buddy of mine says, hey, yo, we're going to have it over, come on over, everyone's coming over, I'll probably show up at that point. But am I going to sit on my couch and pay whatever they want? I mean, there was some rumblings last week that they wanted to go up against a UFC event. I'm like, what are these guys doing?
That's insane. And this is probably going to happen.
That is so MMA.
Yeah, it is. And that's absolutely going to happen.
Last one we got here. Daniel Cormier ever will defend his light heavyweight title?
That's a tough one. And I think the answer is I'm selling this. He will not do it. He will never. He won't do it. He won't defend the 205 title again.
Yeah, I don't ever see him defending this title ever again. I just think he's his day, and I guess the only fight to me I see him at 205 would be against John Jones, because I just when he's talking about looking for that payday, there isn't one there for him.
Yeah, Yeah, so you're certainly right, and it just comes down to whether or not John Jones, I think, wants to cut down to 205, and I think the answer is no, absolutely not.
Yeah, it's we'll see what happens there. But right now, we're going to get into the interview portion of this week's edition of the podcast. Up first, you're going to hear from Patricio Pitbull, then you're going to hear from his opponent Daniel Veitchel, and then we're going to wrap it up with Michael McDonald.
Hey, Patricio, I really appreciate the time, man. How's things been?
Hey, brother. Thank you. I appreciate that.
This fight is a fight that I think a lot of people have been looking forward to after the first fight happened, but it was a couple weeks ago. This fight got a lot more steam when you mentioned a tweet about how you were requesting VADA testing and you had some pictures of Daniel Veitchel. Where did kind of this come from of why you felt that you needed some testing from VADA?
I don't know if the test is going to happen, but did you see those pictures? That's not normal. It was 20 days of difference. It's too big. I don't know what has happened in his body, but I'm sure it's not normal.
Now, this is the first time we're going to see you since April of last year. How would you describe the last year for you, just professionally speaking, and you obviously we're supposed to see you fight back in November, that didn't happen. I mean, how would you describe kind of what the last year has been like for you?
Eu continuei treinando, mantive o nível de sparring alto aqui para não perder o time de luta. Infelizmente, marcaram luta para mim em novembro, na qual eu machuquei, e apenas 8 meses depois a organização me colocou para lutar novamente. Mas, apesar de que achar que eu podia estar pronto antes, eu me motivei a buscar novas habilidades, acredito que eu evoluí, eu sou lutador diferente de um homem 3 meses a mais para hoje. Então, vou ser lutador melhorado do que me viram há 1 ano e 3 meses atrás.
After I won the title, I kept training and I was hoping to fight soon, but they didn't. They only booked me for November. And unfortunately, got injured and had to drop out of the fight. And I was hoping they would book me sooner. I was healthy in a few time later, but it took me 8 months to get me a new fight. And I kept training and doing hard sparring, so I would lose my timing and my rhythm. And I didn't just sit and wait. I spent all this time working on new techniques and improving the style that I was trying to master. And I believe I'm a very different and improved fighter from the one I was 1 year and 3 months ago.
Would you say the fact that you were ready to come back sooner than this date, that it was at all frustrating to be sitting on the sidelines and not have a fight sooner?
Eu me machuquei em novembro. A culpa não foi minha, a culpa foi de Bellator. Eu estava pronto e lutei em abril. Eu estava pronto quando o contrato dizia que eu iria lutar. Então o Bellator demorou para me colocar para lutar. Eu fiz o meu cap baseado nas datas que eu tinha em relação ao contrato. Me machuquei por desgaste e repetição e, infelizmente, fui obrigado a sair da luta. Em 8 anos, foi a segunda luta que eu saí.
Aí eu tô perguntando se você ficou frustrado, se você demorou todo esse tempo pra lutar, se tava saudado e aí não foi.
Com certeza. Frustrado e quebrado financeiramente, né? Porque isso tudo demanda dinheiro.
Absolutely. And the reason I got injured was because of Bellator not booking my fight when it was supposed to be regarding to my contract. So after my fight, I stayed ready and started camp for the date I was supposed to fight. And then they told me I would only be fighting in November. So my injuries came from a repetition of efforts. I had to train more for longer than I should have. And all injuries started piling up. And not having a fight as soon as I got healthy was very frustrating and draining to me, especially financially, because all this time I only spent money and didn't win anything.
In terms of, I guess, one of the biggest stories in all of MMA that we hear about is free agency. I'm not sure, you know, where your contract situation stands at, but kind of what's your thoughts on free agency, you know, as where your current place is? You know, we see all these guys coming in the Bellator. We see some guys potentially like a Michael Chandler, who knows, maybe he comes back to Bellator, maybe be in the UFC. Kind of what's your thought on your current contract situation?
Washington, come on, Marvel's norm is now lógico que vindo o cara de nome, talvez um ex-campeão ou um campeão que desiste de estar em certa organização, seria bom para mim, mas qualquer humano que andar com duas pernas e só tá com dois braços, eu posso tentar. Mas você pensa em testar, por ele, o teste que ele está perguntando. Não importa. Qualquer humano que andar com duas pernas e só tá com dois braços, aí eu tenho. Mas o que ele está perguntando para você? Você...
I'll fight any man that's put in front of me. It doesn't matter to me whoever it is. If it's a man, I'm fighting him. And I don't know if I'm going to test the market or not, because this the MMA market is very volatile. And so I'll think about that when the time comes.
Rankings are something that everyone's going to have a different ranking, but I was looking on Tapology, and they have you as the 17th best featherweight fighter in the world. Is that something that pisses you off?
So, eu depois dele, ele não tem mais titular. Depois dele, quem tem mais que o Max Holloway, que já caiu três juntos.
What can I think about a fight? Oh,
como é que é? Porque antes
da
categoria, já estava acima de mim. Eu já tinha sido campeão mundial, já tinha sido recordista do GP, já tinha batido os caras como Daniel Strauss, Pat Curran, Caracânia, e Daniel Weiss, todos os outros. O cara nem chegou na categoria, estava acima de mim. Como é que eu vou levar em consideração um ranking que bota um cara desse acima da minha posição, se o cara nem me estranha na categoria?
How can I consider rankings like this? You know, tell me another featherweight who has done more at the weight class than me. You have Jose Aldo, perhaps, because of his title defense, but who else? Max Holloway? I've been doing history in this weight class for a long time. I've beaten some of the top fighters in this weight class.
Eu estrei em 2003.
Aí.
Eu andei gelado para o desão dividido. Eu perdi para Ben Henderson, que chegou, que era o top 5 do UFC. Já foi campeão duas vezes. Eu perdi por. Eu tava tipo, batendo ele, nem tocou em mim. Por causa de uma perna quebrada, e quando ela estava me ranqueando.
My debut was in 2003. I only have 3 defeats in the weight class. One of my. Some very doubtful ones. And then one of my other defeats is against a former UFC champion, top 5 lightweight, who I was dominating until I broke my leg. So, who has done more than me to be ranked above me? You see, when Frankie Edgar dropped down to featherweight, he didn't even have a fight in the weight class, and they had him ranked at second. So, these rankings are bullshit. I don't pay much attention to them. I don't think they are fair. I don't think people value what I'm doing. When Frankie Edgar dropped down to featherweight, I already had beaten Pat Curran and Daniel Strauss and so many other names. And so far I have several records in Bellator. I have a belt. So how many of these guys have belts, meaningful belts that you can share ahead of me? Who else has fought the way I have fought since I made my debut? You know, you have guys like Cub Swanson ahead of me. Are you serious? You know, now I'm saying there are 16 featherweights better than me. I can't take any of this seriously. It's a lot of crap.
In terms of this fight against Daniel, we all remember how the first fight went and what happened at the end of the first round. Then, of course, you getting knockout in the second round. What do you remember most about that fight? Is there a particular sequence in the fight that really sticks out to you?
A luta foi uma luta breve, né? A luta teve um round e acabou no começo do segundo. Eu lembro que eu estava dominando o primeiro round e ele me acertou faltando 3 segundos para acabar. Não foi um golpe sorte, mas foi um golpe infeliz da parte dele, porque ele me chegou a dar uma final brutal. E no segundo eu sabia que ele ia vir para acabar e acabou se expondo e eu fiz 1-0.
It was a short fight. We had one round and a few seconds of the second round. I remember everything about it. He caught me in the last 6 seconds. It wasn't a lucky punch, but it was a happy moment for me, for him, because he almost knocked me out. You know, it was a big knockdown and had a very good moment after. And when we returned to the second round, I knew he would try and finish it from where he had left, and he would end up giving me the opening that I would need. And if you watch the tape, you will see I'm just waiting for the right moment to capitalize, and I did it.
Final thing, Patricio, I really appreciate the time. How do you see the victory coming against Daniel here?
Second round, left hook, right hand.
Hey, Dale, man, as always, I appreciate the time. I had a chance to talk to Patricio, and I kind of led off by talking about the interaction the two of you had on social media. PEDs comes up, you know, kind of when you see that tweet and what he wrote, what was your reaction?
You know, I directly knew that he couldn't meant this serious. You know, everybody who knows me knows that I'm as clean and healthy as it gets. So I know it was a try to get under my skin, to get me emotional, but it was the wrong topic. It was definitely the wrong topic. Because I also said in many interviews before that I like the idea of more testing, of year-round testing, and that I like to see the sport as clean as possible. So he couldn't get me with that one.
Yeah, it's obviously it's a huge topic that goes on in all of MMA, not just in Bellator. I mean, do you kind of feel like you're getting to that point in your career where you can kind of maybe be that vocal face to maybe push Bellator to you know, because I know drug testing does go on in Bellator. I think people don't realize that does happen. I know Mike Mazzulli does the drug testing for these international shows. But do you feel that maybe you just got to be a little more vocal about it?
Whenever I get the chance to talk about it, I do so. You know, also in interviews around Germany or all around, when this topic comes up, I make my point. I say how I want to see the sport. And also, you know, as MMA is very small in Germany, I have to promote the sport the best way, and that's how it has to be. It has to be a clean and fair sport, and that's what I want to see.
You know, I guess it is, like, that's the word, as a fighter, like, I mean, I'm sure, has there ever been a moment in your career where you've walked into a fight and you've looked across that cage from your opponent and you maybe thought, is he not clean?
To be honest, no. I never thought of that. I never had this thought coming up. When I walked in, and I don't have to focus on things like that. When I walk into the cage, it's more about I really try to be in this moment and to recognize what's happening. And I try not to let thoughts like this coming up or other thoughts. So I try really to focus 100% on this fight.
Another thing I asked Patricio, I just happened to pull up the Tapology rankings, and they had him as the number 17th featherweight in the world, and they have you as number 21. When you hear that, is that do you feel disrespected that that people are voting you as the 21st best featherweight in the world?
Of course, I want to climb the top of the ladder, but I also can understand it for a little bit because I haven't fought since 11 months, so I can understand how you get pushed back in rankings. So I, for myself as a fighter, I want to stay busy as much as I can, and I want to fight as many times as I can, so that I can jump my way up to work my way up to the top. So I know to get to the top, you have to stay busy. And yeah, it was the last. It was because of the injury of Patricio. Yeah, that fight was off. So yeah, I didn't get the chance in 2017. There was no event to fight again. But I think the key is to stay busy, to make leave no doubt about it, to that you are on the top of the division.
When you got the call late last year that the fight wasn't going to happen, do you remember your initial reaction?
Yeah, absolutely. It was I couldn't believe it. The first moment my manager told me that the fight was off, I couldn't believe it. I was like, no, this is not happening. It was. Also, I was very deep in the weight cut, like I was training, I eat less, so I really felt I felt the emptiness, you know. I just came from training, then I got showered and went to talk to my manager, and then he said, yeah, there's no chance that you're going to fight on this event, it's too close to the event, and yeah, that's the situation right now. And then I was like, oh shit. Then I was upset for the situation, but then I directly said I want to fight this year. And it doesn't matter. I want to have one more fight this year. If it's possible, get me one more fight. But yeah, unfortunately there was no open space. And then when I sat back and had some time to reflect about it, I try always to find the good in what's happening, to see the positive things. So, yeah, now, for now, I say maybe this was the time extra that I needed to prepare for this fight, to get myself exactly in this shape, in this mental shape, physical shape that I am right now to become champion.
In terms of reflection, the first fight, we all remember what happened. Have you even gone back to watch that fight in the preparations for this matchup next week?
I've watched that fight, but not really for analyzing of his style or something like that. I just remembered myself what was the mistake, like what I did good in the first round and when I lost my focus in the second round. But like I said, it was not about analyzing technique or stuff like that. I watched his last fights and I know what he's going to do. And I know that the key to win this fight is not what he's going to do, it's what I'm going to do. And that's what I want to focus on.
In terms of maintaining that focus, how do you work on that inside the gym to where there's not going to be an issue on fight night? What can you exactly do?
In each and every training session, sparring session, like live session when we go jiu-jitsu, wrestling or striking and coaches are there, I try always to, like before, I try to be in the moment. I don't try to think about different things than what I'm doing right now. And I always try to have my concentration also on my coaches, that if I get any advice from the outside, I try to implement it directly into the sparring session. So it's really been in the moment. Don't get distracted by things around you. Like focusing on what's happening right now.
In terms of Patricio, in terms of the abilities that he brings into the cage, is there something that surprised you with him the first time you fought him that maybe you didn't think about him when you were preparing for that first fight?
Actually, no. I felt pretty confident in the first fight, and yeah, I would have loved to see this fight going on a couple more rounds to get more the feeling of the fight, but I felt that more the fight kept going, I got more and more comfortable with my style.
Have you thought about what it would mean to German MMA, you know, if you are able to become the champion? I mean, have you thought about what that could just mean to the sport of mixed martial arts in Germany?
Absolutely. It's for me as a person, I want to see MMA big in Germany, and for that, it will be huge to have a German champion here. And this is my goal. My goal is to be the German champion that is an ambassador for sport, an ambassador for the brand Bellator, and yeah, it really would mean a lot to me. You know, I want to get people known about what MMA is all about, and how special this sport is. That is really the most exciting, the most demanding combat sport there is out there. So I would love to see more and more people doing MMA, and also see the sport big in Germany. So it's definitely a big goal for me to become the champion and to bring MMA to Germany and make it even more bigger.
Would you headlining a Bellator event in Germany as a champion be like one of the ultimate bucket list items for you in the sport?
Absolutely. That's what I said a couple times before. Holding an event in Germany, a Bellator event, and defending my belt here, this would be amazing. This would be a big, really big thing.
Do you ultimately feel that that's a trilogy matchup against Patricio?
Sorry?
Do you feel like it's just the way everything's going for you, that ultimately your next fight is defending your title in Germany and it's a trilogy matchup against Patricio?
I don't think that far. For now, I really focus on that fight, but anything can happen, and yeah, I don't mind who I will defend my belt against who. It doesn't matter to me, as long as I can defend it many times, you know. Really what I said before, like, I focus on this fight 100% and I train the whole year, so I stay fit, I stay ready, so I can fight many times, and that's what I want to do. Now I have this fight on my mind. I fight Patricio. I will get that belt, and then I want to defend it and build my legacy in Bellator and in MMA.
Damn, man. As always, I appreciate time, and look forward to seeing the fight next week.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
Hey, Michael, man. How you doing?
I'm okay.
I appreciate the time. Of course, you've got this fight here against a former Bellator champion. You're coming off your Bellator debut. I mean, how would you assess your Bellator debut heading into this one?
My fight with Peter, it was a very interesting fight. It was a cool learning experience, and it just solidifies something that I've learned, which is you can never predict what's going to happen in the fight. And I think, us fighters, we spin our wheels to no end to try to figure out what is going to happen that fight night, and what kind of opponent are going to happen. And you have your opponent, and is he going to fight like this? What's his strategy going to be? And what skills has he corrected? And what problems does he still have that you can exploit? And it just goes on and on and on and on. And I've personally learned that all that is pointless, completely pointless, because you have no idea what they're going to do. You know, when I fought Uriah Faber, I was positive that guy was going to take me down and try to control me. And the guy ends up standing with me, you know, and I was so unprepared for that. He ended up catching me with I think it was a straight right, and then getting me into the guillotine. So it's things like that. You never know what someone's going to do. With Peter, you know, he fought one way his entire career. He'd been freaking 100 miles an hour, super aggressive, and just that mention of that, like, in a pre-fight conference, the day before the fight, I mentioned that the only thing you can do is take, you know, the characteristics of us that have always been unchanged. I said, something that's always been about me that's never changed is just my precision. Something about Peter that's never changed is his aggression. It's going to be my precision versus Peter's aggression. And what does Peter do? Peter told me this. He said that he changed, because I said that, he changed his entire fighting style on a one-day notice and decided to counterpunch me. You know, and it just goes to show even more, you can never know what's going to happen and you cannot try to predict the fighter that you're going to fight. Even if they fought one way 1,000 times, this could be the time that they're changing. You know, it's foolish to count on expecting what they're going to do.
Has there been a point, and maybe it was with Peter, that you maybe concentrated too much on your opponent's abilities as opposed to just, you know, concentrating on yourself?
Yes, yeah, and that's been a reoccurring lesson throughout my life. It, every time I have focused on what they're doing instead of just what I'm doing, every single time it's been a bad result. Even if I still won, it wasn't the way that I wanted, you know, without fail. And Peter, me fighting Peter was just another example of that. You know, I fought Hinnenbrau. I thought I knew what he was going to do, and I didn't. I fought all these people, and I thought I knew what they were going to do. I didn't. I thought I knew how Miguel Torres was going to fight, and I didn't. Every time you expect something, I mean, man, you were just setting yourself up for failure. So now me personally, I don't even watch tape anymore. Every single time, and this might sound crazy to some people, but I have history to back up my decision here. Of every single time I've done it, it's been a negative result. So now I don't watch tape. You know what? I don't even watch fights anymore because I feel like it actually gets me behind the innovation curve. You know, you're always following what someone else did successfully, you know, and there's always a new fad in MMA of, oh, now people are doing these elbows to the side of the head like Travis Brown did. And then all people are doing snap kicks because Anderson Silva knocked out Vitor Belfort or something like that. It's always something new. When someone innovates, everyone's following and tries to incorporate that into their game. And none of these followers are innovating themselves. They're just following. And so I don't even watch fights anymore. I innovate myself. You know, I'm learning an incredible amount of things at Oakdale in May, where I train. And that's nothing to do with what other people are doing. It's all based upon me. And I feel fantastic about it.
You mentioned about Hinnenbrau and the Nova Yao team with Eduardo Dantas. And while Hinnen doesn't train down there anymore, do you see any similarities between Hinnen's game and Eduardo's game? I mean, I know you say you don't really watch a film, but I'm sure your coaches are relating information to you. Do you think it's a similar style fight?
I'm not going to say yes, because as soon as I do, then I'm expecting for it to go one way. And that's a big failure for me, you know, for me to expect that this fight's going to be even similar. I have, to be honest, I have no idea what he's going to do, but I do know he's well-rounded. I do know he's a black belt, and I do know that he's very good. You do not get to be a Bellator champion without being very good. And I know that, and I know it's going to be a very tough fight. I have heard that his fighting style is similar to my older brother, who's probably my greatest training partner. And I'm prepared for that.
Why is your brother your greatest training partner?
Simply put, he is, first off, skill-wise, he is phenomenal. A lot of people, let me first say this, that there is a common misconception in MMA that people think the best fighters in the world are the ones who have the title. And that is not the case. There are a lot of people who can perform at different levels in different ways. And you hear stories of champions in the UFC or Bellator going in and they get mopped up in training by someone in a similar weight class who doesn't have as much career success as them. And Justin Smitley, my older brother, is one of those guys. He made some bad decisions in his early career. And so he's, because of that, he's never had some of the opportunities that I have. You know, some of his early fights, you know, fighting people like Andre Philly and Joseph Benavidez, Sean Klarsik, who, you know, for his very first fight, you know, things like this. So first off, Justin, my older brother, is widely considered by most of the people in California to be one of the greatest strikers that state's ever seen. He's phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal striker. He's also a phenomenal black belt in jiu-jitsu. He's come very far in his wrestling. And the greatest thing about Justin is he is always there for me. And he's not looking for a way to benefit himself. He's a servant. He is a servant leader. He teaches all the kickboxing at Oakdale MMA. And most of it. And he's just an incredible teacher, an incredible fighter, and he's just always there to help. every Tuesday and Thursday morning, aside from everybody else, just me and Justin get together and we just work on MMA and what we want to do. And every single time when I have a fight coming up, he comes up and he says, what's on the agenda today? What do you want to do? You know? And then when he's got a fight coming up, same thing for me. I come up and say, hey, how can I be here for you? Well, what's on the agenda? What do you want to do? You know? And so we have a really good flow of working together, and we just know each other's bodies super well. We can go hard and not get injured. It's fantastic.
Now, when you signed with Bellator, I think the perception was, all right, you're going to be right into a title matchup, and that has not happened yet. Is that something that you wanted to kind of get a couple of fights under your belt before fighting for the title, or it just hasn't been offered to you?
Right. I would say that, first off, I'm not naive to the responsibilities of being a champion. I am aware enough to know that I don't know what the responsibilities of champion are. And there's a lot more than just fights. Everybody wants to think that, you know, you see a little snippet of someone's life and then you're like, oh, I want to be that. You know, you see a lot of these young fighters, you know, they see Conor McGregor has some money. And so they're like, oh, I want to be a fighter. I know what that life's about, you know, and there's a lot more to it than just that. And same for me, looking at like being a champion, I don't know what Bellator would ask of me as their champion. I don't know what media requests they'll have for me. I don't know what event requests they'll have for me. There's a lot of things that I don't know what they would ask of me. And to be completely honest, I like the level of involvement I have in the MMA world right now, and it's not much. I'm not a huge fan of like MMA being my life. It's not. It's my job. And when I'm done with my job, I like to come home and not do my job of MMA anymore. You know, so I don't know what that would entail completely, being Bellator's champion. I don't know what they'd ask of me. So it's not exactly something I'm excited about, because I don't know what exactly it would look like. And just to be completely honest, if they want more, like if Bellator wanted more media from me, if I became a champion, I would tolerate and I would do it, but I wouldn't want it. You know, it would be something that I stomach, basically, but I don't enjoy the life of, famous guy or whatever.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've talked to a couple guys about this recently, about what life after fighting looks like. For you, what does life after mm-hmm. fighting look like?
Yeah. Well, there's an easy answer immediately, because this is easily foreseen, because I'm already doing it now. I made a change between me going from the UFC to Bellator. There was a change that was made, and I'm never going to unmake it. I'm never going to undo this change that I made. So I've been woodworking as long as I've been fighting, and I've also considered myself to be as good at woodworking as I am at fighting. And it's something that I absolutely love. And I have a business where I build custom cabinets and furniture throughout my week. Woodworking pays my bills. Currently, this is how my life is set up. Woodworking pays my bills. Fighting income is investable. Much like Stipe Miocic, who has another job, and then he comes in and fights when that job isn't required. And I say that my life is a lot better. It's a lot more stable. And you never know when the end of fighting is going to happen. Even if it's temporary, you don't know when it's going to happen. There was a time when I had, I think, three hand surgeries, or two hand surgeries or something like that, in the course of 2 years in between a fight. I didn't have a fight for like 2 years working for the UFC. And you never know when those are going to happen. And that's a problem when my wife is relying on me pulling the money, yet I can't trust my career. And it's has nothing to do with just the UFC or Bellator, even just with injuries. I might, or let's say I lose three times in a row and Bellator decides not to sign me again, and I can't get any other offers. I have no idea what's going to happen. You know, so fighting as a general industry right now for fighters is not a stable industry. It's one that's very high risk, high reward. And I think that the risk is too great for the reward right now. So I have another job, which is building custom cabinets and furniture. The easy answer is that would be immediately what takes my full income. And second off is I would most likely go into part-time ministry work somewhere locally for hopefully my church, because I love my church. But that's probably something else that would increase. I'm involved in ministry right now, but I don't get paid for it, and I don't think I'll ever want to really get paid for it. I don't think that's necessary, but I will definitely pick that up and do more ministry with more of my time when fighting is done. But I can't commit to any ministry right now because fighting is so inconsistent with my schedule.
There you have my interviews with Patricio Pitbull, Daniel Weichel, and Michael McDonald. A very up Pitbull about the rankings that is on Tapology. And very fascinating to hear Michael McDonald talk. A guy that does not do a lot of interviews. I really appreciate him giving me some time to talk about, kind of going in this matchup. And that's a big matchup there on Friday night there in Oklahoma. Michael McDonald and Eduardo Dantas, that's clearly the fight on that fight card that I'm really paying attention to. I will tell you, coming up this week on the MMAReport.com, I will have interviews with Chris Honeycutt and also Gerald Harris. I had a chance to talk to both of those fighters about their fights coming up on Friday night. So look out for that one. It is a four-fight main card. Julia Budd defending her featherweight title against Italia Nogueira. Chris Honeycutt taking on Leo Lette. Look out for that one. Not a bad Bellator card on Friday night. Then, of course, they've got the fight card on Saturday over in Rome. And then, of course, we have the UFC fight card. Do want to mention a couple of questions that we got in as we were recording the podcast. First up, Joe from Houston says, why hasn't John Jones been tested in 2018? Tom Lawler, who's also suspended, has been tested in 2018. Joe, right now, I don't have the answer to that question, but I'll have to reach out to USADA on that one.
That's stupid. That's insane.
That is
what the hell is going on here?
Yeah, exactly.
John Jones should be tested like 12 times a year.
By the way, I have a feeling Paulo Costa is going to become the most tested fighter in the UFC by USADA in the near future.
That guy, him and Francis Ngannou are like, they are the all buff team. I mean, I don't know what other divisions we got, but those two dudes. But yeah, especially Paulo Costa. Paulo Costa looks like a pro wrestler.
Yeah, no, he does. This is more of a comment from Chris. He says, how can people say they want fighters to make money and get paid and then bitch about the Lesnar thing? Are they hypocrites or ignorant? Please choose one of the two options. Thanks. Hypocrites. That's what it is.
Okay. Well, there's a difference. I kind of see the point in that maybe they could be saying fighters should get more money from the promoters in the cut, but they're against WWE champions doing pro wrestling angles in a cage. Because I will say this. That thing with Lesnar and Cormier screamed fake.
It was so yes. Fake. Oh, yes. That and felt so staged.
And guess what? Every friend that I asked, I just asked them, what'd you think of the Cormier-Brock thing? That was 100% the feedback. Wasn't I'm looking forward to the fight. It was fake.
It's the way Cormier called him in there, and then once he kind of came in there, you knew what was going to happen. I know it wasn't staged, but it felt like it.
Well, it felt like this was classic pro wrestling where both Lesnar and DC were in on it, and they both were acting, despite the fact that maybe it wasn't staged. Both these guys knew exactly what they were doing, and I bet afterwards they went to Denny's together to share a beer. You know, I bet those two guys like each other. And Cormier is a student of pro wrestling, and it just came across as too fake. Like, that's the difference between – and people are going to watch the hell out of that fight, obviously. They're going to make money regardless. But that's why, like, the Cormier-Jones thing is that much better because it just comes across as more authentic.
Well, here's the question, and I've seen people debate this on social media. What gets a bigger pay-per-view buy rate, DC Brock or DC Jones?
Oh, DC Jones. Without a doubt. Well, not without a doubt. But
Brock's has had pay-per-view buys of over a million, I believe, three times. Jones never has.
Jones has never had a million buy rate pay-per-view?
I saw someone tweet about that the other day. I think his most is like 800,000 or 900,000.
That's crazy to me. So, I mean, with the proof of statistics – It is kind of insane for me to say without a doubt it's John Jones Cormier.
I think the question.
But I still think it's that.
I think the question I have is more of, is there still that WWE fan that is not an MMA fan that is going to fork over $65 to watch Brock fight?
I don't know. I think every WWE fan that's an MMA fan will watch that fight.
It's just because I also think that, you know, you're at this point where the WWE fan is, you know, they're used to paying, you know, $10 a month to get all the WWE content they want.
Mm-hmm. I know, but I just think that it's completely different. Well, the thing is, Lesnar wrestles like 4 times a year, but I just think it's a completely different animal. And I think those people will watch the UFC regardless, even if they spend the money to get all that content. I think the Lesnar Cormier thing is going to be a big event. People want to be a part of big events and they'll watch it. It's just the reason why I say John Jones DC is a bigger fight is just because I think that I just think it's the perfect end to a story. And you're talking about two major stars. And I think for sure that would be John Jones' first $1 million buy rate. I'm just looking at. Yeah. Yeah, man. That's crazy.
By the way, I did thought it was brilliant for Golovkin to attend UFC 226 on Saturday night and do a session with the media. I thought that was brilliant on his part.
How so?
Well, I mean, just because of introducing himself to an MMA fan that may not know who he is.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I hope to see him fight, Canelo. But
what's that, September 15th, I want to say?
Oh, that fight's on the books?
Oh, yeah, that's locked in.
I'm like the least educated person about the Canelo Golovkin fight because I remember not too long ago I was like super excited and I did not see the news that fight got canceled because of this. So I just don't know anything about Golovkin Canelo, but I can't wait till they fight.
I just remember watching that first fight and when the scores were read, I'm like, are you kidding me?
It's like, man, those people, it's rigged. They wanted a rematch.
It was more frustrating than anything else. I mean, I'm like, are you kidding me? I mean, it's, we didn't mention PFL. Man, Jake Shields looked bad. Oof.
Yeah, like the two guys that are building the show around, Shields and Nurmagomedov, went out there and got L's. But Shields, gosh, it was the type of performance that makes you think, man, maybe he shouldn't even fight again because he got demolished.
Oh, man, that fight wasn't even close. I mean, he was just getting torched on the feet. And the one thing that was crazy to me about that fight was Ray Cooper, like, wanting to play the ground game with Jake. I'm like, what are you doing, dude? Clearly, you are annihilating him on the feet. Why the hell are you wanting to do that? But, PFL's next event is next week. It's a featherweights and the heavyweights again. So we've Lance Palmer be headlining that card. Andre Harrison, Nasrio Malgari. That's a nice little matchup on there. Alexandre Almeida, Steven Seiler is a good one. I will tell you what, I've enjoyed the PFL so far.
Me too. It's a great product. I really enjoyed the NBCSN broadcast. It's real fresh. I feel like the pacing is great too. It's not the greatest thing in the world, but it's above and beyond better than the UFC.
The only thing that's tough for me, Daniel, is actually staying awake on a Thursday night till like 11:30 at night.
Yeah, I get you. And it's a little different because I get that one extra hour advantage being in the central time zone. So it kind of fits perfectly for me. Yeah, I would imagine that 1 hour delay is kind of rough though.
Yeah, I mean, because I get up, you know, anywhere between 5:30 and 6 every day. So once it starts getting about 10:30, 11, if I didn't get a nap and it's a struggle for me.
Yeah, I have empathy for that. I'd never do that, and that would be awful. If I had to wake up at 5:30 every day, I'd have to go to sleep at 7.
So should our listeners be looking for any Daniel videos from Parts Unknown this week?
Yeah, I have a couple days off of college before I go back to finish my degree. For people that don't follow me on social media, I actually graduated college, like with the walk-in, but I still have some classes to do before I finish my degree. So I'm like a 6-year senior after walking, still going to class. And most of the conversations I have on campus is, didn't you graduate? Kind of, but not yet. So I have a couple of breaks to think of ideas.
Your Instagram stories are hilarious.
Thank you. They're primarily so girls message me and it's no success. Like they'll message me with the ha ha ha. and then I'll just be like, so dinner later, and just no response. So
especially your Instagram story yesterday about your father's business.
Yeah, named after my dog instead of myself. And then they named the business after my dog, and my dog
is legit. This is a legit story. This is like, you didn't make up a funny video.
No, that it happened. I mean, it's been a while. They named it Bear Home Builders, which is, my dog's name is Bear. But
yes, your dog is a familiar cast member to your Instagram stories.
The thing is, I have to edit it because, like, or I have to edit what I put on there because my dog doesn't like me. Like, he kind of gets scared a lot. So, like, I have to make sure in the video he doesn't look too scared so people don't call, like, animal control. I'm not a bad dog owner. My dog just doesn't like me.
And I did see you finally got a haircut.
I did finally get a haircut, yeah. It's, I'm retiring the pro wrestling boots, Jason. I was thinking about being a pro wrestler, but I'm going to be honest with you, it kind of hurts. So
did we ever talk about the fact that you went through pro wrestling school one day?
I'm not sure. I've done. I have texted you that I did attempt to do pro wrestling training.
What was the worst part?
Oh man, the worst part is, God, whenever you, the worst part is like, God, that's a good question. Okay, the worst part is definitely like when you have to pretend to feel pain or profess like you're selling, right? The guy has you in a headlock and you gotta like,
yeah.
And it's just so awkward, you know, the noises that would come out of my body as I attempted to make the right noise to match what was happening in the ring was so uncomfortable. So that was awkward, you know, guys chopping you like with chops, you know, because that's the thing you do when you start out. Those stuff were the worst, but it generally hurt. But it's just not for me. I think I need to do things that are less painful.
So you'll sit here. So I can guarantee you're going to be here next week talking on the microphone.
Absolutely. That is my. I love doing a job where I can wear as few clothes as possible. Although I am wearing some clothes, so just throwing that out there.
Well, that's good.
But you know, if the listener prefers without, it's up to y'all's imagination. Go with whatever you'd like.
No imagination going on over here. But that is going to wrap it up for this week's edition of the MMA Report Podcast. Of course, if you ever want to check out Daniel's social media, you should definitely do that. On Twitter, it's Daniel Gavon, DGG. Of course, I am at Jason_Floyd. Going to have a bunch of interviews up this week on themmareport.com, so look out for that. Of course, you can always subscribe, rate, and review to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, and Google Play. Of course, this podcast comes out every Wednesday morning on RadioInfluence.com. Come next week on the podcast, going to be joined by Ricky Simon, who talked about his fight coming up here at UFC 227 on August the 4th. So once again, I am Jason Floyd. He is Daniel Gavon, and you have been listening to the MMA Report Podcast on Radio Influence.
This is a Landry Football with Chris Landry. Quick Fix on Radio Influence.
I look at some teams that have tough schedules that might be in the mix, some of them not in the mix in terms of a national player. But I look at a schedule like an LSU and think that's a really tough schedule. If you look at it, they've got, first of all, in their own league, they've got the two best teams in the league. Not everybody has to play Alabama and Georgia. Those are the two best programs, two best teams in the SEC by far, and you have to play both of them. That's going to be quite a challenge for LSU. They open up the season playing Miami in a very difficult game. That's a real challenge. And, you know, going back, they get Georgia at home, and they get Alabama at home in Baton Rouge. But those are games that if LSU played them in Baton Rouge, they played them in Athens or Tuscaloosa, they played them in Iowa, they're probably not going to win those games. The swing games, the Auburn, the Florida game, the A&M games, those are all on the road. So if you look at the schedule and analyze it, it becomes a little complex in that if you do as I do and say it is very unlikely that they beat Georgia or Alabama, but the Auburn, Florida, A&M games are swing games that you're going to all have to go on the road. So how does LSU come out of those games?
Chris Landry brings you Landry Football every week on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and of course, RadioInfluence.com.